Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we will be talking with Professor Shira Klein, who is joining us from Chapman University in Orange, California. She'll be talking with us about her new book, Italy's Jews, From Emancipation to Fascism. Shira, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to our discussion. Before we get into it, though, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. I was born in England and I was raised in Israel, and I did my undergraduate degree at Tel Aviv University and my MA in Rome, in La Sapienza, and then I did my PhD at New York University, where I double majored, so to speak, in history and in Judaic studies. And I guess I mention that because my work, as I'll sort of speak about in a moment, encompasses all three countries, which is the US and Israel and Italy.
And so how did you, let's get into the book then. How did you come to write Italy's Jews? What brought you to the topic?
Well, as I mentioned, I went to Italy for my MA. I actually went there even earlier as an undergraduate in an exchange program from Tel Aviv University. And I was immediately intrigued by Italian history and by the Italian Jewish community today. And I sort of put it in the back of my mind and then went on with my my graduate degree, and then I started my PhD, started in a totally different direction. I was looking at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and then I decided, wow. Yeah, totally different. I was sure I was going to write my dissertation on that. And decided to change directions, and I wasn't really enjoying working on the conflict. And I thought, what am I going to work on? And I started reading about reading Italian Jewish history, sort of going back to that moment in my travels, and thinking maybe this is something that I could explore. And I found that there was relatively little out there in terms of secondary sources, particularly for the Anglophone world. And I thought, why is this? And what else could be said? And how does it compare to things I'd read a lot about, like German Jewish history or Israeli history? And what's missing from this field, and how can I maybe address it? And since I had Italian, I thought I might embark on that project. But I also wanted to look at migration, since this was another interest of mine. And then I sort of put that all together and came up with this project that looks at Italian Jewish history in a sort of large swath of time from the 19th century to post-World War II. But it also looks at a large spectrum spatially or geographically. It looks at refugees in the United States and in Palestine that came from Italy.
And the book really does examine, yeah, quite a span of time. Tell us about this myth of Italian benevolence that you sort of seek to dig into. What does it claim?
Yeah, so that's really one of the main themes of the book. It looks at what I call, and what other historians have called, the myth of Italian benevolence, and it looks at what Jews' role has been in that myth, or in supporting that myth. So what is that myth? That's a good question. The myth of Italian benevolence is this idea that Italians in World War II save Jews and help them. And that Italy, well, there's several renditions of the myth, but either that Italy had no racism of its own towards Jews, or no anti-Jewish policies of its own, or in some variations of the myth is that, yes, it did have some racism, but it really paled in comparison to what Germany was doing. It was just an import from Germany, so it was a poor imitation of German racism. And it really didn't have the backing of the Italian masses. It was something that, at most, Mussolini and a few of his henchmen wanted or did, but that most Italians were far from this racist outview, or very far removed from persecuting Jews, and on the contrary, that Italy's role in the war was to save Jews. And all of those points are not exactly true, and that's why they can be called a myth, or the myth of the good Italian, or the myth of Italiani brava gente, which means, again, Italians are good people, or the myth of Italian benevolence. It's got all these different names. You can pick and choose.
Okay. Yeah, I think I was taught that, you know, Italy was an ally of course, of the Axis powers, but that they weren't participating in, actively at least, in the anti-Semitic elements of the war.
Yes, that's exactly the myth and the truth. So the way to grapple with this myth is to look at what actually did happen. And what actually did happen is that Italy pursued a brutal racist policy towards Jews. And it did so completely independently of Germany. And it did so over the course of several very long years. And I say very long years because they were very long years for Italian Jews, very much suffering that Italian Jews had to endure. And that even after the German invasion, and I'll speak about that more later, but even after Germany does come into the picture and does start calling the shots, even then, Italy has an independent role to play in rounding up the Jews and handing them over to the Germans. And so that's why this idea of Italy having no racism, or very little racism, or just an imitation of German racism, that's why that's just a story. It's a wrong story.
Okay. So far from being passive, they were actually not even just collaborators, but actively setting out.
Propose
anti-Semitic policy.
Yes.
So what other, in addition to this question about, you know, the truth behind this this history of Italian anti-Semitism, what other questions did you set out to answer with your book, and how did you go about researching them?
Right. I think that question of Italy's myth and what was the role of Jews in creating this myth. So that was one of my questions. And another question was, looking further back, I wanted to look at how Jews fared under fascism before everything went wrong. Fascism came to power in 1922, and the first racial laws come on the scene in 1938. And I was wondering, what was life like under fascism before then, during those 16 years? And I was curious as to why Jews didn't leave Italy at that time, because we think of fascism today as, you know, fascism is wrong. I mean, if you're an enlightened person, you'll probably agree fascism isn't something very nice. And so why did Jews choose to stay under that regime when nobody was forcing them? So that was one question, sort of what was Jews' relationship to fascism? And I found some very, very surprising findings in that respect. And another question was, what was happening with Jewish culture in the modern period in modern Italy. And again, I was looking at this assumption. You could also call it a myth, but perhaps more an assumption that in the wake of emancipation, Italian Jews became so Italian that they lost their Jewish culture. And I had read about other Jewish cultures in Western Europe and in Central Europe, like Germany and France. I'd read that that wasn't the case, that they didn't assimilate, that they didn't share their Jewish culture. But yet Italian historians of Italian Jewry seem to argue that they were. So that was another assumption that I wanted to tackle. Did Italian Jews really, really lose their Judaism? And again, over there, I found some surprising answers suggesting that it wasn't as simple as that.
So how did you go about then answering these questions? I mean, what archives did you go to? What sort of material did you look at?
I looked at archives in three different countries. I looked at archives in Israel, primarily. So those in Israel were primarily to look at Italian Jewish refugees who fled to Palestine in 38, 39, 40, 41. Okay. Then I looked at archives in the US, again, looking at refugees who had fled to New York or other places on the East Coast, a few also on the West Coast, fleeing the racial laws. And mostly I looked at archives in Italy, particularly in Florence, Turin, Rome, Milan, Venice. These were some of the centers of Italian Jewish life. And I looked at archives of the Italian Jewish communities. And then I did quite a lot of digging as well outside of the archives. So I met with, well, I would say dozens of people to collect unpublished memoirs. You know, when people, particularly when people grow old, they start writing their life stories, maybe for children or for grandchildren to read. And I said, can I have a copy of that?
Wow.
And so I got all these unpublished materials that could by rights be in archive, but in archives, but aren't. And,
right.
And that was important to me because one of my passions, I would say, is to give a voice to the people who don't normally find their way into the historical record. So these are people who. Sorry.
How did people react when you asked them for, you know, their personal memoirs?
Often with surprise, because often they didn't think that there was anything of importance in what they'd written. They thought, oh, it's just my personal story. And also often people thought, particularly those who had migrated as refugees or even who had survived the war in hiding, they thought, well, if I wasn't in Auschwitz, then maybe my story doesn't count as much as that of a camp survivor. And then I would have to do some convincing work to say, well, actually, these are very interesting stories, right? They tell a story that has virtually been uncovered until now, and it's worth your while giving me a copy. Then I of course will deposit those, or have already deposited most of them, in an archive, so that in case future scholars would like to look at them.
Okay, fascinating. So let's move on to sort of what you found when you went through all of this material. So the focus of your book is, of course, how Jews experienced the Second World War in Italy, but you also do talk about the history of Jews and specifically Jewish Italian patriotism in Italy in the century really leading up to the Second World War. I wonder if you could give us some background information on this history.
Sure.
For us amateurs.
Absolutely. So if I can backtrack for a minute, and I'll just say, if one of my questions was, or one of my arguments is that Italian Jews played a role in forging or in supporting this myth of the good Italian, and they did that by saying really all those things that I mentioned before that constitute the myth, which is Italian Jews said, that Italy didn't really mean to pass its racial laws, that Italy never meant to round up Jews, that that Italy was just importing this racism from Germany. And I was curious as to why Italian Jews would say those things, why they would give such a flattering view of Italy when that wasn't exactly the case, right? That didn't really happen. And to answer that question, I wanted to go further back than just the World War, just the Second World War, because it seemed to me that there had to have been deeper roots for that kind of narrative that they were cultivating. So I looked back and I reached all the way to the 19th century when Italy is born. And Italy is born in, the movement to unify Italy is in the 1830s, 1840s, and then 1861, the Kingdom of Italy is born. And I wondered, how did this have to do with what happens later? And what I found is that Italian Jews equated the Italian state with liberty. And they, yes, they thought that that they owed their liberty. They owed the fact that they were living outside of the ghettos, that they had become equal citizens. They believed that they owed that to the Italian state, because up until statehood, Italian Jews had been discriminated against, as most European Jews had been before what historians call emancipation, which is the process of getting equal rights. And Jews in Italy, in the same way, had been discriminated against. Most of them lived in ghettos. Most of them were subject to restrictions as to what they could work in. And it wasn't until Italy becomes a state, it's not until the birth of modern Italy, that Italian Jews gained their emancipation. So they hold this image of Italy as a liberator. And when the racial laws come out, that sort of view of Italy informs their reaction. And they say, there's no way that this country that gave us our liberty, to whom we owe our liberty, there's no way that it could turn against us. And so they end up saying it must be that Mussolini was forced by Germany to pass these racial laws and to persecute Jews. It must be that Italians don't support it. It must be that Germany is leading Italy, kicking and screaming, into discriminating against the Jews, and so that's why I went further back, and the other thing I found when I went further back that again informed the way that they were reacting to persecution in World War II was that Italian Jews were rather happy under fascism from 1922 to 1938. They were mostly middle class. I call the period of what happens to them from the late 19th century until 38. I call it the rise and rise of Italian Jews in my book, because really they're just they're having a good time. Italy has an industrial boom at the end of the 19th century, and Italian Jews are very well placed to benefit from that boom. They're mostly in the north, they're mostly in the towns or in the cities, and they're mostly in trade. And that makes them really well placed to rise up the ranks of the social ladder and go into the middle class. And even fascism doesn't really mar their sense of belonging in Italian society. In fact, fascism catered to the middle class. Fascism's whole slogan was to quash the strikes of the working class and to bring the working class under its thumb and to control the working class so that the middle class wouldn't have to worry about disruptive strikes or about a Bolshevist revolution or about any other kind of threat to the status quo. And Italian Jews, along with the rest of the middle class, breathed with relief when Mussolini came to power, because he put an end to this turbulent time working class turbulence. And throughout the 1920s and 1930s, they either support Mussolini or they're indifferent to Mussolini, or they mildly oppose him. But very few Italian Jews diametrically opposed him. I'm not saying that none did. There were famous Jewish anti-fascists, but the majority of Italian Jews did not really mind fascism, and some of them even supported it. So, again, that when the racial laws come along, they just can't believe that Mussolini could be behind it. They can't believe that it could be Italy's independent choice to persecute them.
So when then were anti-Semitic laws introduced in Italy? When did things change legally for Italian Jews?
Well, things really change in summer of 1938. July of 1938, the Italian government issues what they call the Racist Manifesto. And this manifesto says Italians are a race and Jews are not part of that race. And from there, things deteriorate very quickly. The first racial law comes out soon after that, and it defines Jews. It says, you are Jewish if X, Y, Z. So it tells you what it means to be Jewish. And then it discriminates against Jews. Okay. So there was any number of discriminations. Children could no longer go to public schools. Italian Jews could no longer marry non-Jews. Jews could no longer work in most professions. They were fired from the civil services. They were expelled from the military. And after these laws which were signed by the king, then came a spate of directives which carried just as much weight as the laws, and these were endless. So Jews could not advertise, they could not be on the radio, they could not go to the seaside, they could not rent an apartment in certain buildings. They could not work in any number of professions. And the list goes on and on. You name it, it was probably there.
Wow. So it seems like these Jews who were, as you described, pretty comfortable up until 1938 were very suddenly hit with extremely drastic and strict racial laws that discriminated against them.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. And you get in memoirs and in testimonies and even in diaries from the time, you get this the language that Italian Jews use to describe this. They often refer to the weather. They often use a weather metaphors, and they say it was like a bolt of lightning or thunder in the middle of a blue skies day or a storm that suddenly came upon them without any forecast. And this is really how they felt. They were totally in shock. They said, what? How on earth could this have happened? And I think that shock is also partly what informs their disbelief and their unwillingness to believe that this was an Italian initiative, totally independent from Germany, because they had been so happy under fascism and in Italy before 1938. But unfortunately, this disbelief wasn't warranted, because things just got worse and worse with time. So 1938, you get all these directives, and life becomes ever harder, ever more isolated, and they become social pariahs, and some of them even try to immigrate because of that. And then in June 1940, Italy joins the war, and from that point you get internment of mostly foreign Jews, some native Jews as well, in concentration camps. Mm-hmm. Again, these are totally independent of Germany. These are homebred concentration camps in Italy proper. And then later on you get forced labor as well. So some Italian Jews are subjected to forced labor, particularly in manual menial labor, such as lugging lumber or very difficult things like that. And these are not just top-down directives. These are grassroots initiatives as well. So you get people hanging up signs in their store saying, no Jews here, or this is an Aryan shop. And no law said that they had to do that, right? That was one of the, I said, you name it, and it's probably there. But actually, there were lots of things that Italians, non-Jewish Italians, did that were not decreed by law, and that they just took the initiative and went ahead and discriminated against their neighbors. So things like graffiti, things like casual violence, slaps, cuffs, child bullying gets much worse during these years. And then, of course, financial abuse, whether buying out Jewish businesses for very, very cheap, and that kind of behavior. So you get a mix of top-down policies, but also grassroots anti-Semitism. And one of the things that happens during this time, from 1938 to 1943, because 43 will be a very big turning point, but from 38 to 43, you see something that will recur after 43 with very lethal consequences, and that is denunciations. So from 38 to 43, when Italy is totally independent and it has these racial laws and it's discriminating against the Jews, ordinary Italians, so civilians and just, you know, folks sort of on the street, so to speak, they write letters, anonymous letters to the police, denouncing Italian Jews for evading the racial laws. So if they find someone, for instance, who has hired a Christian babysitter, and that was something that was forbidden to do, Italian Jews could not hire Christian help, then they'll write a letter saying, such and such person who is a Jew has hired a Jewish babysitter, please go arrest them, right? Or please go and intervene. Yeah. And so you get these, again, these grassroots initiatives basically betraying Jews so as to better implement the racial laws or get the police to better do their job.
That's so interesting, because I think of when we, you know, when we talk about denunciations during the Second World War, we think of individuals denouncing people simply for being Jews. But I suppose that it was different in Italy, because the Italian government was really mostly, as you said, incarcerating foreign Jews. But was it that to incarcerate Italian Jews, they had to sort of break a law, or am I understanding that correctly?
So they incarcerate foreign Jews. That's true. They put them in concentration camps and a few native Jews as well. But you know, if you broke the law, then you could be stopped, or you could be fined, or you could be sued, and so that's what Italian denunciations are trying to do. They're saying, look, this person is breaking the law. Go and do something about it. And up to 1943, the consequences are not lethal. But from 43, and maybe this is a good time to segue into what happens in 1943. So 1943 is another big turning point. If I said the first turning point is 38 with the racial laws, 43 is when things get much, much worse. And ironically, they start getting worse by seeming to get better. Let me explain that. So summer of 1943, the Allies land in North Africa. And Jews are absolutely overjoyed to hear this, because it looks like Italy is going to soon be taken over by the Allies. And the Italian leadership, seeing that the Allies are getting closer and closer, hastily decides to switch sides. Not Mussolini, but the rest of the leadership, yes. And what they do is they oust Mussolini and imprison him at the top of a mountain. And they secretly switch sides they start negotiations with the Allies. And very soon, when this becomes known and the Italians sign an armistice with the Allies, then Germany pours its forces into the north and rescue Mussolini and reinstate him at the head of a government called the Government of Salò, because it was headquartered in Salò, which is a sleepy little town at the tip of Lago di Garda, which is a lake in northern Italy. And then Italy is effectively split into two. In the south, the Allies are around and they work their way up, and the front line keeps inching northwards as the war wears on. And in the north, you get the Germans and the Italians, you get a joint government in the sense that Germany has full military power, but Italy has administrative control. And that's important because it meant that Italy was in control of the police. And more on that in a second. But what happens is that as soon as Germany enters Italy, it does what it does by that point. And we're talking about September 43. At that point, its policy towards all Jews in Europe is very clear cut, and that is deportation to killing camps in the east. And that's exactly what it does. So it goes around Italy and starts deporting Jews to go east, to primarily to Auschwitz. So the Germans act solo for a while in these deportations, but in late November 43, the Italian government decides that it too wants a hand in deporting Jews, or sorry, in rounding up Jews. And what it does is it issues Police Order Number 5, this important directive in Italian history. Police Order Number 5 says, Italian police will round up Jews, put them in concentration camps or in prisons or in places where they can be watched, and confiscate their capital. And that is exactly what happens. So Italian police go around rounding up Jews and confiscate their capital and then hand them over to the Germans. The Germans put them on convoys. They get sent to Auschwitz where they're gassed when they arrive. And so again, here you see Italian complicity or Italian initiative, because Police Order Number 5 was totally an Italian order without any pressure from Germany, and it made Italians complicit in rounding up Jews and confiscating their property, and you can probably see the motive behind that, which is that they wanted Jewish property, and here is where the denunciations became lethal, because. Because if Jews were in hiding, and an Italian, let's say, neighbor or acquaintance or business a competitor happened to know where an Italian Jewish person was hiding, they could denounce them, and there was a price on Jews' heads, so they could even get rewarded for it. And denunciations were widespread at this time. So what begins in 38, with denouncing Jews for evading the racial laws, turns into 1943 into these very dangerous denunciations that mean that Jews could get caught by Italian police or by German soldiers and get sent to their death. And the fact is that almost half of all rounded up Jews that we know of were rounded up by either by Italian police working on their own or Italian police working together with German soldiers.
Wow. So there really was this active Italian participation.
Yes. And that's something that the other historians have shown as well. And that I mention in the book, sort of building on what other historians did. But one thing I do that is new is look at interviews and oral testimonies. And I've looked at 425 oral histories in the USC Shoah Foundation. Wow. Of Italian Jewish survivors, which are basically all of the interviews by Italian Jewish survivors in that database.
That's incredible. As someone who's used oral testimony, I will say that is a lot of work.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily listen to each one of them from start to finish, but fortunately, there's this lovely little thing called keywords, which you can search. And I looked for mentions of betrayal, and I found that fully a quarter of all of these interviews mentioned a betrayal. Now, you may think that that's a little, you may think that that's a lot, but consider that this statistic would have definitely been larger if the victims of Auschwitz had been able, in some theoretical world, to give their testimony. Because, of course, this is a self-selective group, right? Those who survived were less likely to have been betrayed. And even there, fully a quarter of them mentioned a betrayal. So it would probably have been a larger percentage if we'd had more testimonies of those who were actually deported.
Wow, absolutely. That's fascinating. So then we have this group, or a couple of groups of Italian Jews who escape Italy. And I found your discussion of the Italian Jewish refugee experience particularly fascinating. Could you tell us a little bit about what you uncovered about their history and the history of Jewish refugees, specifically in the United States and in Palestine? How did their experiences diverge or overlap? And how did they see and perceive Italy from afar?
The Jews, several hundred Jews go to the United States and several hundred go to Palestine. And although they're a small group, they actually have a very interesting role particularly those in the United States, in strengthening this myth of the benevolent Italian, right? To go back to that theme that we were talking about before. And what happens is that these refugees in the United States, they get there in late 38, right after the first racial laws come out, and then 39, even 40, 41, if they can get out of Italy that late. And they develop a curiously nostalgic memory or view of Italy. Which is not to say that they are pro-fascism or anything. They become vehemently anti-fascist, whatever their sympathies with fascism had been before the war. After 38, you find very few Jews who are pro-fascism, if any. But even though they're anti-fascist, they sort of weave this image or this painting, weave a painting, that doesn't quite work. Let's start again.
Weave a tapestry.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. They weave a tapestry of what life was like in Italy and what Italians are like, which is very, very flattering. And again, a sort of verging on the mythical. And what they end up saying is Italy and fascist Italy are two diametrically opposed countries. And they say there is a line that you can draw between Italy and between fascism. Of course, that wasn't entirely true because many, many, many Italians were fascist, not to mention some Italian Jews had been fascist, right?
Right.
But they say if you are fascist, you are not Italian. And for them, the true Italy is the anti-fascist Italy, and that true Italy would never do anything to harm Jews. And so they sort of, again, I don't want to say spin a tale because that sounds that they're doing it sort of malevolently. And I don't think that was the case, but they definitely tell a story about how Italians were just absolutely fabulous and absolutely good, and how Italy was the most beautiful country and beautiful in its environment, but also in its soul, and how it was Germany had led it kicking and screaming into doing all these vile things, not just against Jews, but against the world or against the Allies. And why do Italian Jews in the United States tell this story? Why do they support this myth? For a couple of reasons, but one reason was because they were very nervous about the United States going to the peninsula and bombing it. Because they still have family there, right? I mean, the refugees are a very tiny minority. The majority stayed in Italy. And so they're worried about what the United States is going to do when it reaches the shore of the peninsula. And you actually get speeches by refugees saying, American soldiers, when you go to the peninsula, when you go to Italy, just remember that Italians are your friends. And so that's one of the reasons they do it. Another reason is definitely because they're trying to reach out to the massive Italian American audience there. And so they're creating what they think of very consciously as propaganda, which is saying most Italians are anti-fascist, and therefore you, Italian American listeners or readers, whether it's radio programs or newspapers, you should also be anti-fascist. So by trying to persuade Italian Americans to be anti-fascist and to sort of to hate Mussolini, they are effectively telling a story about Italy as a totally anti-fascist country, which of course it wasn't.
It's fascinating because just because you already talked about the self-selective nature of groups who avoided being denounced, I suppose this group also hadn't had that experience likely of denunciation, or had they?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. They probably, because they left rather early, right? They weren't there in 43, and they weren't even there. I mean, those of them who leave in late 38, right? They don't even experience all the isolation and the discrimination and even the other laws or directives that come out later on. So in a sense, they might have actually had a more, slightly more benign experience than Italian Jews who stay in Italy and certainly those who stay in Italy past 43. But interestingly, in private correspondence, Italian Jews are actually pointing a slightly more blameful finger or slightly more accusing finger at Italians. And they're saying, just between ourselves, we know that many, many Italians are collaborating with the Germans, right? If it's after 43 or even before 43, just between ourselves, when I was kicked out of my art studio, the artists around me gloated, right? So they're saying, just between ourselves, things aren't as perfect as they seem. But when they start publishing, right, and Italian Jews have a strong presence in the anti-fascist press in the United States and on radio programs, when they speak publicly, that's a totally different story. And there, they're a lot more exculpating towards Italians, or a lot more flattering.
Wow. So there's a big difference between the private conversations that they have among fellow Italian Jews and how they present this image of benevolent anti-fascist Italy.
Yeah, somewhat of a difference. I mean, I wouldn't want to sort of to overstress that point, but yes, and I suppose that's I guess that's the nature, right, of public speaking versus private speaking.
Absolutely.
Like in this interview, obviously, I won't I won't go into my deepest secrets, but whereas in maybe in a private WhatsApp or email correspondence, I might divulge a little bit more. But yes, there's certainly that element of the public sphere versus the private sphere.
And so how does the situation of Italian Jewish refugees in Palestine compare to that of Italian Jewish refugees in the United States?
Very different in the sense that Italian Jews in Palestine do not at all speak about Italy with that kind of nostalgia. And if anything, they castigate Italy, because what happens with Italian Jewish refugees in Palestine is they find themselves landing into this very Zionist environment, and the Zionist environment of 1930s Palestine rejected anything that had to do with the diaspora. Diaspora being defined as anywhere outside of the land of Israel, which is a term that that Zionists used for Jewish Palestine or the Jewish community in Palestine. And the idea behind this was that Jews should not live in the diaspora. They should be moving to Palestine to set up a national Jewish homeland. And Italy, along with anywhere else in Europe or anywhere else in the world that wasn't the land of Israel, fell under this definition of diaspora. And Italian Jews adopt this kind of jargon. They adopt this kind of language, and they say, "Oh yes, Italy is a diaspora. We want nothing to do with the diaspora. We're going to become good Zionists. We're going to become good Jewish nationalists." But still, what we find is that without even realizing it, or certainly without publicly acknowledging it, they're clinging to Italy. And that, by the way, was one of the titles that I was considering for the book. Yes, but of course, an author rarely gets to choose their own title. So, but what happens is that they cling to Italy in the sense that, just as the refugees in the U.S. Are clinging to this pink or seeing in Italy through a pink lens, or clinging to Italy to a good view of Italy, to seeing Italy as a sort of beautiful place in heart and in soul. In the same way, refugees in Palestine are clinging to Italy through its culture, through their lifestyles. They're making Italian food. They're wearing Italian clothes. They're listening to Italian music. They're decorating their homes with Italian furniture. They're reading Italian literature. And through all these different ways, they're actually importing if you will, a little Italy into Palestine, and without realizing it, very much continuing their diaspora ways in this sort of Zionist hotbed.
And I guess those elements of clinging to Italy were presumably less, you know, less intentional. They're sort of accidentally keeping these Italian ties in some ways.
Yes, exactly. And they're doing it while at the same time really criticizing any Italian Jews who either chose to go back to Italy after having immigrated to Palestine, right? If they weren't happy in Palestine, some of them chose to go back.
After the war, exactly.
Yes. Or even after the war, those who chose to stay in Italy, right? Survivors who had survived in hiding or come back from Auschwitz or come back from fleeing to Switzerland. Not everyone wanted to go to Palestine after the war and Israel from 1948 onwards. And these refugees who had come in 38, 39, 1940, they end up really harshly criticizing these folks. So they'd really internalize these Zionist messages of all Jews must live in Israel or in Palestine before 48. And yet, interestingly enough, in their lifestyle, they were totally Italian.
And did you find that these Jews, these Jewish refugees who went to Palestine, were they Zionists often before they went to Palestine? Did they choose to go to Palestine because of that, or?
That's a good question. I think the majority of them had some ties to Zionism, so some ties to Jewish nationalism, some ties to thinking about Jews as a nation or thinking about a homeland, but certainly that wasn't their main reason for going to Palestine. Their main reason was the 1938 laws.
Right.
So in a sense, the push factor was far more important than the pull factor, if you will. Mm. And it's not as though the whole world was open to them and they thought, where shall I go today? I think I'll go to Palestine because I'm so Zionist. It was a very, very distraught time for Jews. Most countries were closed to Jewish refugees, not just Italians, but all countries. All Jewish refugees. For instance, the US had a strict quota system. Britain had migration restrictions. France did as well. And Palestine had some restrictions as well, but there were ways of getting a visa to go there. So I think it's probably a combination of having some Zionist affiliation or some Zionist right. feelings, like for instance, maybe they had contributed to the Italian Zionist Federation, or maybe they had given money for settlement in Palestine, or maybe they had bought a book or a newspaper that was affiliated or that spoke about Palestine. But really it was the racial laws that just made them want to up and leave as quickly as possible.
Right. So Shira, because we do have a bit of time left, I wonder if you could tell us how this book, especially, you know, belonging to a body of literature that might not be as developed as German Jewish history or even French Jewish history, how do you see it fitting into new directions in Jewish studies, in Holocaust history, and in those fields?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I might refer first of all to the historiography, just Italian historiography, right? The field of Italian studies, and so there's a whole history about the Bravagenta myth, right? The myth of the benevolent Italian, and it's not just about Jews. So for a long time, it was thought that Italy had been just one of the good guys in World War II, and that its occupation, for instance, of Greece and the Balkans had been really benign, and that its treatment, even before World War II, its treatment of its colonies in Africa had been very benign, very kind. And then in the 1990s, a new generation of historians began questioning this very flattering view of Italy and began saying, was it really as it seems? And historians that looked at Italy's occupation of Greece said otherwise. And historians that looked at Italy's occupation of Ethiopia said otherwise. And historians that looked at Italy's treatment towards Jews said otherwise. So it sort of fits into this broader trajectory that tries to understand how Italy really acted in all these different scenarios, and suggesting that it wasn't as kind as had previously been thought. But what I found, and so all of that has sort of other historians have definitely acknowledged, but what I found fascinating was that Jews themselves, Jews were the very victims, or one of the groups of victims, right? Because of course there were victims in the Balkans as well, and African victims. Perhaps the most victimized of all, or those who suffered the most, are the African victims. But I was wondering, how did Jews who were the victims of this very aggression, how did they come to support this view of Italian benevolence? And so that's where I saw myself as making a contribution to this historiography, this larger Italian field. And then as far as how it contributes to Holocaust history, I think there's some really interesting work taking place, very cutting edge research that likes to contrast what happened in the war or happened in the Holocaust with what people think happened. And there's really interesting work that has been done about France concerning the Vichy syndrome, and interesting work that has been done in Germany concerning Germans trying to sort of sweep the Holocaust under the rug. And there's work being done now about the Netherlands as well, and about Poland. And so I was interested in how the Italian case fits into this this sort of juxtaposing what we know happened in the Holocaust with what films might say about what happened, or newspapers, or even Wikipedia, so popular perceptions of the Holocaust and how they differ from what actually happened. And could I actually say something that sort of kind of digress a tiny bit, since I mentioned Wikipedia?
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to tell listeners about what's happening with Wikipedia and these histories. And in Wikipedia, where Wikipedia is one of the sources for the myth of the good Italian, because if you look at the Italian the article or articles in Wikipedia on the Holocaust in Italy, or on Jews under fascism, or on the racial laws, you get statements like most Italians oppose the racial laws, or the racial laws were imposed on Italy by Germany. So classic classic benevolence myth 101.
Right.
And of course Wikipedia has a far, far greater audience than my book could ever hope to have, or you know, any other book dispelling these myths could ever hope to have. And so it's just one way of suggesting to us why this myth is so powerful. Because we get places like Wikipedia, these really popular fountains of knowledge, perpetuating them. And another source of that kind of wrong view is Life is Beautiful, which some people listening to this may have seen, right? La Vita è Bella, a very famous Italian film. And so, again, in my book, I sort of explain how that gives us a very, very entertaining, right? Very fun to watch.
Uplifting at the end.
Yes, but very false view of what was actually happening in Italy.
Shira, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. And I know we've taken up quite a bit of your time, and also that this book itself has been such a huge undertaking for you. It's really an immense achievement. So this next question might sort of seem crazy considering that. However, what are you working on next?
that's a very good question. And one, I have to put in my tenure file too. So I should know the answer to that. I'm actually interested now in looking at Italian Jews and the colonies in Africa, and the intersection or sort of the encounter between Italy's Jews and Italy's empire. because when I was looking at Italian Jews under fascism in the interwar periods or before 38, I found, I think what I mentioned is this curious phenomenon of Jews not really opposing Mussolini. And one of their reasons for not really opposing Mussolini was that they were quite thrilled about Italy's foreign policy, and in particular, its imperial achievements and Mussolini's imperial achievements. So I'm really interested in looking at what kind of encounter Italian Jews had with the colonies, and was it as simple as just having a colonial mindset, or was there something more complicated at work there? And were they looking at African Jews and thinking how maybe Italy's presence in Africa could help indigenous Jews in Africa, places like Ethiopia, we've got the Falasha, places like North Africa and Libya, there was a very large Jewish community. So that's sort of very briefly what I'm going to look at next, and wish me luck at the very, very start of that next project.
Definitely good luck. That sounds like a fascinating and extremely understudied field. I look forward to reading your next book.
Thank you. And then so we'll meet again in the next interview.
Yes, definitely. In a couple of years. Yeah. Shira, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been wonderful.
Thank you, Robin. It's been my pleasure.
That was Shira Klein talking about her new book, Italy's Jews, From Emancipation to Fascism, which is available now through Cambridge University Press. You should check it out. This has been New Books in Jewish Studies. Thanks so much for listening.